This is the PropTech VC Podcast. We give you unique insights into how innovative technologies are disrupting real estate. We interview top entrepreneurs, investors, and knowledgeable experts to share the inside scoop in this fast-moving industry. It's hosted by leading PropTech VC, Zane Jaffer. Let's dive into today's content.
Let's now talk about the core problem you're solving and, you know, the state of the industry.
Yeah, happy to. Did you have a question? Or do you want me to jump right into it?
Yeah, I do. So you were frustrated so much that you decided to go and start a company. You know, were there other ways to fix this? Could you not just find a broker you trust? And there you go. Now that broker is going to win-win just like you will because of their honesty and integrity. What made you go the whole way to launch a whole company around this problem?
This goes to the very sort of, I guess, it's a personality flaw I might have, where what I do when I get excited about a potential project like this, there used to be something called, I think it was called the Sequoia Business Plan, I think. They used to publish like how you write out a business plan, which is like a, in their words, like a 15-page deck or something like that. I had that template. And so when I would get really excited about an idea, I would go build one of those Sequoia business plans as if I was really going to launch the business to see if I could kind of pitch it to myself first. And then, like, if I got really excited, then I would pitch it to other people.
So, Carl, you needed a structured way to think through an idea. And I don't know if you're like many of our listeners here, but for me, when I have an idea, I can't switch it off. I have to do something with it. Right. I have to put it on a piece of paper. And it's not enough because then your brain can go crazy thinking about the potential. And the danger with an entrepreneur is they will be too optimistic. They will overlook some of the tripfalls, right, that hurt many entrepreneurs. Having a structure, like you mentioned, forces you to look at the business objectively. So how many times did you do that, by the way? Was this like an addiction that every now and then you'd come up with an idea, or was it quite rare?
I would take it to the deck level probably every 2 months or so. It was actually a fairly heavy lift, and so I'm sure I did less than 10 of these before I finally said, okay, this is the one. But you know, if you're really being true to yourself and following that template, it's like, you know, all the stuff you see in a deck, like market size. Well, you're going to go do a real market size analysis with like the TAM and the SAM, all the different market sizes, right? The competitors, like you're doing a deep dive, and it's pretty labor intensive. And I would actually make it like look pretty too. Like I'm gonna actually build the deck, you know what I mean? And so once you do that, you kind of look. So there's one idea I had that I ended up abandoning. That was also in prop tech, but it was more on the rental side of the market. This is before AlphaLead. It was on the rental side of the market, and it was around more like management of like landlord management type stuff. I won't get into the whole thing, but I looked at once I built the deck. The economics just sucked. And I just said, I've since seen people launch the same thing. And every time it kind of just doesn't work out. And I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I didn't try that. But the building the deck to me was how I got my mind around all the economics, all the everything. And so that's
it's interesting that I wrote about this and I have an article called The First 48 Hours of Your Startup or something like that. And basically the goal of it is to kill your startup idea as quickly as you can in the first 48 hours. If it can survive you trying to kill it, then you're forced to do something with it, right?
Yeah.
You're obliged.
Yeah.
A lot of entrepreneurs start a company because they felt like there was no other option. No one was solving this problem. I didn't want to do it. I had to step up and do it because it was such a frustrating thing. And I tried every reason why it could fail. And in the end, I just said, you know what? This is worth it. But I also think you develop a muscle. Once you do this exercise enough time, once you get enough reps in, you start to analyze deals a certain way. So, you know, before I became a venture capitalist, my co-founder was an angel investor after the company was sold. And even, you know, before that. And, you know, I asked him, why don't you go launch a company? He goes, I'm too skeptical now. I have analyzed so many deals. Sometimes you have to be naive as an entrepreneur and not have that muscle and just go at it, but the chances are very high you're going to fail, right? As you develop this muscle and you become seasoned at analyzing companies, you also become quite skeptical. But I think it's a very important skill to develop. And I think having done, as you said, probably 10 seems like the right amount. I also believe you need to have gone through enough validation exercises or, you know, analyzing a startup enough times and shooting down the idea enough times so that you have something to compare it against. Once you start to appreciate this next idea I've come up with has a bigger TAM, has a different go-to-market strategy, has a different customer base and customer profile. Once you've flexed those muscles, then you're really able to, I think, de-risk the process. I'm also assuming, though, as a banker yourself, you lived in this world of due diligence, right? And so you also probably took it a little bit more extreme than other founders might do.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. I think the more than anything else, I try to be super honest with myself. Because,
right.
Like you said, like, as the founder, you start to get very excited about your baby.
Yeah.
And you're like, ooh, this baby is really, really pretty. But like, going through the process, you start to say, oh, this baby's not, there's some problems with this baby, right? And so I think
to add, time to kill the baby, right? That's like the hardest thing to do is when you're married to the idea. So you did a lot of walk me through it then. How did the template look? And at what point did you stop going on Google, stop going on your computer and start taking phone calls and start talking to people? How did you make that transition of actually going from your own, I would say, secondary research to then doing primary research?
Yeah, it was interesting. So the first thing we did, so I built this deck and I started to get delved into the numbers, I got even more excited. That was a good sign too. Like, if you had excitement before and then you built a financial model and you're like, ooh, this is even better than I thought. Like, this is right. So then what I started doing, and so we had this alpha lead thing, which was a lawyer matching, almost like a Legion service for lawyers in a lot of ways. But because of that, I was on the road a lot, pitching at lawyers' conferences, meeting with other lead generators. I kind of like had the whole market mapped out pretty quickly on who was selling leads, who were the lawyers, and how do you monetize this, right? I started pitching my business to some of these people at these conferences. So I said, hey, I got this alpha lead thing, and I know you've just bought 1,000 leads from us. Awesome. What do you think about real estate? And they said, what do you mean? What do you think about real estate? And I said, well, it's different from this, but here's how it's analog. And so I started pitching it to other like partners.
Who were not in real estate, right? They were just
in real estate. They were just people in the lawyer lead gen business. Because a lot of what was happening in real estate at the time looked sort of lead generation like.
Yeah.
Right? And we didn't want to do lead gen. We wanted to do something different, but there was enough of an analog where I could explain the matching that I said, look, there's something missing between the collaboration between the consumer and the real estate agent and all the other service sort of vendors that you need when you transact. And I think I have something that could pull that together. And so that's the other thing. So I started getting in front of as many people as I could. And some founders are fearful of that. It's like, oh, somebody's going to steal my idea or they're going to hate my idea and I'm going to be discouraged. And I think you have to kind of, like, for me, it was like putting my ego aside and just going and being like, first of all, I don't think anybody can, if somebody's going to steal it, they're not going to do it the way I'm going to do it.
Exactly. So, you're the designer of the blueprint. And if they steal the blueprint, they're not going to appreciate why you architected things a certain way. And ideas are cheap. It's all about execution at the end of the day.
Yes. And so that's what I did. I started putting it in front of as many, and I started getting validation on some of the points that I thought were most crucial. Of course, you get the only naysaying stuff I heard was the stuff that anybody that is afraid to start a business would say, right? Because this is still a risky endeavor.
And so you heard feedback from partners and people outside of your circle highlighting the risks.
Oh, yeah. Right away. And the big one was around, you know, for instance, customer acquisition costs. That's where a lot of people dig in right away. And these guys, some of them are big-time players in Legion. They know exactly how much it costs to acquire a customer, right? Across multiple verticals. One of those guys joined my board, by the way. And so one of the top guys who was an expert in customer acquisition, I was hitting him up on this project to the point where he said, hey, do you need some help? Do you want to? And I said, yeah. And so that's how it worked to get me the validation I needed to understand it. And also I picked up a partner in the process as well.
What advice do you have for anyone listening who's thinking about starting a company? You've been there yourself. I've been there myself too. But what would you advise for them as they're listening to this and are on the fence? What should they do?
It's a good question. For me, pain tolerance is one of the biggest things. You have to have a lot of pain tolerance. I was reading, the hard thing? Ben Horowitz book. And he was talking about how something always goes wrong. And I remember reading that and being like, always? That seems like pessimistic. Why does he say always? And then like literally, within months, I was like, oh, yeah, something always goes wrong, right? And so whatever your plan is, and then you think about these guys, you'll see, like in the tech crunches of the world, and you say, oh my gosh, overnight success. They just raised $200 million. And if you really go into those stories, it's almost never an overnight success. It was something that took years and years. And then when you see it in the news, it sounds overnight, right? So there's a lot of pain, a lot of scar tissue in between that. And so I would say just like prepare yourself for that. And then if you've done the work, if you're like, to me, like we hear no's all the time on our business, right? But I've done the work. I know kind of the core aspect of it. And I'm extremely positive on the outcomes. And so that pain doesn't, you know, you get used to it and you keep pushing. I think that's my number one thing.
Yeah. I'd also add on the practical side, make sure you have enough funds available to support yourself.
Yes.
You're going to be unpaid for a long time. And it's going to, I'd say budget 24 months.
I agree with that.
Of personal runway without salary to work on this. And in that period, you can assume at the end of that, you'll either make revenue, have a bit of profit, or you'll go raise some funding and you can take a little bit of a salary from that. But it's going to be, let's say, high risk that you'll ever make more than you would working. And probably like year 5 to 7 is when, if your startup does well, you'll be getting the same salary. And at that point, you've got all that equity in your company and it's doing well. But it's a long road. It's not an overnight success. And it's a high chance of failure. 90% plus chance.
100% true. From a salary perspective, I've made a lot less than I made as a banker. Right?
And that must be hard because you're in investment banking. And look, many bankers are short-term focused. And many bankers, too, take big checks. And it's hard to leave a very successful career where so much money to make. And frankly, once you're in the game, it's a sad thing, right? The rich get richer, but also when you're in a position where you've got access to opportunities and you're a banker, you know you can make X amount minimum every year, you know? And you know there's
a certain... Yeah, and also you got to remember, almost everybody I know, they went to business school, they had those business school loans. So like you have to be thoughtful about these decisions, which again, I say it's part of this is a personality flaw because this thing really bugged me so much and I got so dug in, I was like, I have to do it. You have to have that runway. Personal runway is key.
Carl, I'm guessing too, given there was an opportunity cost and the sort of guaranteed career progression inside of banking, the opportunity cost was big and you had to make sure what you do next can be big as well. Significantly big. You're not launching a startup to go make some, you know, money and pay the bills. And that's a terrible reason to start a company because, you know, I mean, a company, yes. A startup, no. Startups are not lifestyle businesses. They're highly scalable, disruptive companies. So how important for you was the market sizing? Were you one of those guys who thought more about, look, let me find a niche, let me get a position in the market, and then we'll figure it out? Or were you focused much more on TAM overall and just... Yeah. That being big enough?
No, it's a great question. I think about TAM, I think, and I shouldn't say this. I don't know if I think about it differently than others or not, but for me, it wasn't just TAM, which was really important for me for this business. It was TAM, and then it was a fragmented nature of the TAM. So real estate to me, it's a very open space where to be big, like Redfin, when Redfin went public, they had like 40 something thousand transactions total, right? There are about 6-7 million transactions every year in the United States for real estate. So I saw that number and I said, oh, they went public with like 40,000, like that's like, I can do 40,000 transactions. Like, and so that was kind of like my thinking, right? Like, so you think about a TAM, it can't be in isolation. It has to be, well, what's happening within that TAM? And if there's somebody that's already sort of dominating it, it becomes very difficult to displace that dominating.
An $8 billion market cap, and from the March lows, this stock is up 4-5x.
Yeah, they've done well. It's crazy. But you know what that is? There are sort of some amazing macro trends around that, right? So when the pandemic happened, people thought, oh my gosh, there's not going to be any real estate transactions. And it went the other way, right? People were moving more to these less urbanized places. If you look at like video tours through the roof, up like 1,000%. So the way that people, it accelerated a lot of macro trends in real estate that were that Redfin and Zillow and others in Abode were poised to take advantage of, right? Because we're digital platforms that allow people to more easily transact. And so all those stay-at-home stocks, the Zooms and the Peloton, like, they're all benefiting from this acceleration into, oh, I can actually work out at home now. All right, like, let's go.
What's going to happen, Carl, post-pandemic when there's a vaccine? What's your thesis on how the home ownership market's going to look? Are people going to go back to cities that they're fleeing right now, the New Yorks, the coastal cities, the San Franciscos?
I think certainly in the medium to long term, for sure. I don't know if it snaps back in 2021 right away, but I think that if you look at the sort of benefits that a city offers, those have not changed. And I don't think, I mean, this pandemic was scary. It was awful. Lots of people lost their lives and had health problems. But I think especially Americans have very short memories. And if you think about those things that people get excited about cities, that's not going away. And it might even, I have a feeling, it might even, you know, people, I've been hearing, reading about this whole roaring 20s idea that this, I think the big flu we had here right before the 20s, the 1920s, kind of, when we came out of that, people went nuts.
With a vengeance.
With events, with eating out, going out, dance. I think entertainment, like, we've all been locked in since the better part of, you know, what, February, March timeframe. I know I have a list of places I want to travel to. I have a list of restaurants I want to hit up as soon as there's a vaccine. Like, I'm going out. I'm not staying in. Now I'm like, am I ever staying in again? This is, you know. So I think that's a real thing. And
I guess what you're saying is that if you take a step back, people are leaving these big cities, maybe temporary, maybe permanent. They're now somewhere in a beautiful, you know, I envy you if this is the case. You know, you're in some nice, beautiful nature, or, you know, you're with your family. God bless. That's a great thing, right? But eventually, once the vaccine is out, you're going to look around your small town city and you're going to realize, where are the amenities? Where are the restaurants? Where's the nightlife? And if you're in your, if you're young, especially, I'm guessing you're going to miss that. And people will go back to these destinations with a vengeance, the San Franciscos, the New Yorks.
Absolutely. New York, I remember reading, there was like a blog that was like, New York is dead. And I was laughing out loud. I was like, okay, have you ever lived in New York? New York is one of the most amazing cities on the planet. It's never going, I mean, it's not fun when there's not a vaccine, because you can't ride the subway, you can't do all the things, right? The restaurants. But once those things are open again, what better place if that's your thing?
Human beings, when they are in that fear greed cycle, right? They're very short-term focused. They're not thinking long-term at all. And we tend to overreact and exaggerate the bad times, you know?
Exactly.
And they don't last forever. This too shall pass is one of my favorite quotes. You know,
100%.
And it will pass, and it will forget about it. And hopefully the lessons we learn from COVID are ones around environmental sustainability, the fact that, you know, our actions impact our neighbors. And, you know, there's a lot of problems that have been highlighted, both in social, political realms, and also supply chain logistics and stuff. But, you know, we can come out of this better and stronger as a society. We'll be adopting technology that can make our lives better, but, you know, we will forget about these times. And you know, it is trauma for everyone listening who's gone through this. It's this dark period in our lives that, you know, going through a traumatic incident, you want to forget about it. And, you know, how one day you'll be, you know, telling someone younger than you, you know, we were on lockdown. We had to wear masks. Yeah. We were worried about this invisible virus.
Yeah, it's really, you know, I felt like for the last few years, I've been living through kind of a sci-fi novel anyway. And this just took it to
because you're running a startup as well. Your ups and downs are another level, right? Everyone's got this up and down now with COVID, but being a startup entrepreneur right now, that gives a whole another level of the roller coaster.
Absolutely. I was fortunate. I had some really good investors and advisors that, you know, some of the advice they gave to me in March was like, okay, this is how so we invested in you because we believed in you. Like, now you're really going to prove it, because just surviving one of these things as a company is like, that's a win, right? Yes. And so that was really cool. I think certainly we learned new techniques. We learned new, I mean, we tried out new price. I mean, we didn't sit still. Every day was like a virtual war room, where we were trying to figure out, like, where's the wind blowing and how are we adjusting and can we get ahead of anything? And
this is, by the way, this is a great time to start a company. You know, Microsoft, MailChimp, Uber, Slack, Venmo. So many companies have emerged during recessions, and this is the time to really cut your teeth, you know.